too. It's 3 minutes to four. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. With me is one of the great English theater and film actors, Alec Guinness. He's just written a memoir titled Blessings in Disguise. It's impossible to type Alec Guinness because he's portrayed a remarkable assortment of characters. In fact, in the film comedy Kind Hearts and Coronets, he plays eight roles, a shunned heir to the dukedom and his entire family. John Gielgud gave Guinness his first big break, casting him as Osric in a 1934 production of Hamlet, in which Gielgud starred and directed. For about the next 12 years, Guinness performed on the stage in the classics, plays by Shakespeare, Chekhov, and Shaw. After the war, he started making movies. Films like Kind Hearts and Coronets, The Lavender Hill Mob, and The Lady Killers established him as a great movie comic actor, but he was also recognized as a great dramatic film actor and won an Academy Award for his starring role in the 1957 World War II film Bridge on the River Kwai. In 1959, he was knighted. In the last few years, he's reached a brand new audience as Obi-Ben Kenobi in the Star Wars trilogy. On public television, he recently received raves for his portrayal of George Smiley in the adaptation of John le Carré's Smiley's People and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. In 1984, he co-starred in A Passage to India. In 1980, Guinness was presented a special Academy Award for advancing the art of screen acting through a host of memorable and distinguished performances. Alec Guinness shares some of his own memories in his new book, Blessings in Disguise, published by Knopf. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You learned acting through doing the classics. A lot of people start now doing movies or doing contemporary plays. Do you think that's the best way to learn, by doing Shakespeare?
I don't know about nowadays, but in the England of 40-something years ago, 50 years ago, yes, it was, I think. I mean, there were some great, great classical actors around. And the classics taught you how to speak and how to keep still and present yourself in that way. I think those are still admirable virtues to have, if you have them. But they also need to be broken through, you know, with more modern work.
How to speak and how to keep still. The speak, I understand. Explain the keep still.
Well, there's so many young actors I admire tremendously, but I've also seen so many young actors who fidget and distract and don't know where the focus, an audience's attention and focus should be. And if they fumble, scratch themselves, twitch, you know, they're drawing attention to themselves, but to no great advantage of anyone else.
Your first mentors were John Gielgud and Tyrone Guthrie. They both directed you in your early work. You describe them in your book as the two people who did the most to liberate English theater. Liberate them from what?
A kind of fustian. The drawing room comedy with the soubrette and the funny maid and the... not that they were writers, but they sought theatre elsewhere, and they brought over, Gielgud brought over foreign directors, foreign designers. Guthrie was very concerned that the theatre shouldn't be, English theatre shouldn't be localised in London, that it should reach the provinces, and he did a tremendous amount to, in that way, of spreading theatre, and of course... later was responsible for about five or six open stage theatres, starting with the one in Toronto, Stratford, Ontario.
Gielgud and Tyrone Guthrie directed your early performances. It sounds as if they were absolutely complementary in their approach to directing. Can you describe the differences between the two?
Well, I think Gielgud was a tremendous disciplinarian and very impatient. Impatient with the young people who couldn't do what he wanted. He was 10 years older than me, for instance, and at the height of his romantic appeal and excitement at that time. So you could become very inhibited if you were young and nervous and tentative. And then to kind of do a year with him, and he was absolutely, he wouldn't tolerate any sloppy speech. And then move to Guthrie, who... was wonderful with the young and encouraged the young, and it didn't matter. Do, you know, let yourself go, and was rather mean with the middle-aged and the elderly or the successful. He wanted a discipline of another sort, but it was a very good balance to have this hard line of Gielgud's and then this swift, free line of Guthrie's.
You were in productions of Hamlet directed by each of them. Your first role that really got attention was as Osric in a production of Hamlet that Gielgud directed and starred in. Did you watch carefully his performance in that production?
I think I watched probably every single performance that he gave from the wings, if I wasn't changing my makeup or doing something like that. So I don't know how many hundreds of performances I must have seen of it.
Could you describe some of the things that you feel you learned by watching him that intently?
I don't know now. I don't know that I was even consciously learning, oh, you do this, you do that. I'm sure I wasn't. I was kind of lost in admiration for the beauty of his speech and the kind of brilliance of his interpretation, because it was, the 1934 production was his definitive performance in that part. I didn't sit there, or stand there rather, you know, thinking, oh, do it like that. Unconsciously, no doubt, I absorbed quite a lot of his technique. Later, I discarded it.
In the 1938 production of Hamlet with Tyrone Guthrie, I think that's the one you performed first in modern dress. Is that something you wanted to do? Did you approve of doing Hamlet in modern dress?
Well, I was delighted. I didn't know I was going to be offered the part. Guthrie had come to a production of The Merchant of Venice, in which I was playing Lorenzo, on a matinee. It was a Gielgud production. And came round to see me afterwards and said, can you come to the Old Vic Theatre tomorrow afternoon, because there's something I'd like to discuss with you. Went down there, and there was no one else about at all. And we sat in the dressing room, and he said, how about coming next season and playing Hamlet? Well, I nearly passed out with astonishment and delight. And then he said, how would you react to doing it in modern dress or something equivalent to modern dress? And that had always rather appealed to me. So again, I said, snap. And he said, oh, you could wear the very nice grey suit you're wearing now. And I said, no, it's not nearly good enough as grey suit. I must have a lovely blue suit or black suit or something. But there was a great advantage. It was done in its entirety, which is very rare. I mean, you know, lasting, what, nearly 4 hours or somewhere around 4 hours. Because you get an impression of what the situation is. I mean, for instance, when the ghost appears in the middle of the play in the Queen's bedroom, the ghost appeared in a dressing gown, which was very, very... it reminded you of what the marital situation had been. It was those little things. When I turned up after the sea adventure at the end of the play at the graveyard, I wore a sort of torn old fisherman's jersey and gumboots and, you know, as almost down and out in a seaman-like way. It helps to paint the picture because we don't know enough about Elizabethan costume to know those sort of things.
I think there's probably an obvious trap for young actors performing classic works, which is that so many people have performed those roles before you that you might try to do something to distinguish yourself in the role and develop certain eccentricities just to show off and show that you can do it differently. Do you find that that's true?
Yes, I'm afraid I do. I mean, I get a bit sick of... I've no doubt done it myself in the past, but not very consciously, let's do it this way, you know, to be different. And that certainly wasn't the case with Guthrie over that Hamlet. He really thought the play had something more to give that he could give through that type of production.
My guest is Alec Guinness. He's written a new book called Blessings in Disguise, which is a memoir. Do you remember any lasting advice that you got in your early years of acting about enunciation or breathing or speaking lines?
Many, I think. But I think all advice is something to discard sooner or later. when I first used to go and have, I was trying to get a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and I went to Martita Hunt, who's an actress who acted here in Philadelphia, I know. And she formed my taste, I think, a great deal. And when she heard me reading one of the kind of little rule of thumb that she gave me, was she said, you know, for heaven's sake, never put the emphasis on an adjective unless you have to, or an adverb. Go straight for the verb, because that is the driving force of the sentence. Now, it doesn't mean to say that every time you speak a verb, you've got to plug it. But it did form, I think, the basis of my own appreciation of speaking, of listening to people. And I hear nowadays so much false emphasis, not just in the theater. In fact, not so much in the theater as on railway stations when they tell you, you know, they say that in England, you know, they'll say the train for such and such a place will leave from platform some. And you think, was there any doubt about it? And you get confused instead of them just saying the train for such and such a place will leave at such and such a time. And
did you go through a period when you were starting out of studying the gestures of every stranger who you met, so you'd acquire all these, you just acquire a whole gallery of gestures and speaking styles that you could use in roles?
Well, I certainly used to follow people in the street thinking I could, I mean, when I was a very impoverished student, thinking that I could learn something from the way they walked or feel I knew something about them, and very consciously did that sort of thing. Occasionally now I will still, if something catches my eye, but not for immediate use, and I like to forget them so that if I do use something that I've observed, I don't know where it's come from. It's from way, way back. I've rather scraped the bottom of the barrel now.
I was thinking that your early period on the stage must have really played havoc with your ego. Your first acting teacher told you that you weren't any good. She wanted to give you back your money and send you on your way. At your first audition at the Old Vic, the director yelled for you to get off stage. And he used an obscenity in saying it that we won't repeat here. And you really have to have a lot of either stamina or belief in yourself to keep coming back after that kind of rejection. And I wonder what you had or what kind of passion for theater that you had that kept you going.
I don't know. It's very difficult. Looking back with hindsight, I suppose I was very obstinate. And in my rather shy way, certainly in those days, I suppose I was very determined that I wasn't going to take no from people who weren't necessarily first class. And I think this is kind of quite good. I mean, it's a tough profession. There's enormous unemployment, anyway, in my country. And I think, without being too aggressive, an actor needs, when he's very young, to have that sort of thing, I'll starve, but I'm going to do it.
Did your feelings about your own talents waver depending on what kind of feedback you were getting at the time?
No, I don't think so. I think I kind of put my head in the sand like an ostrich and thought, no, I'm sure I've got something. I wouldn't let myself doubt too much, although I realized I was totally inadequate.
You nearly starved going to the theater initially. You didn't have a lot of money. You were apparently living on apples and rolls so that you could save money to go to the theater. What did you really love about the theater? And what was that experience like for you going to the Old Vic when you were very young?
Well, I mean, I sort of fell in love with the theater, you know, as a boy, certainly consciously by the time I was about 14, I suppose. It was a different world. I didn't have a tremendously happy childhood. I enjoyed myself at school because that had a solidity, it had a regular pattern to it. And the theater provided another life, other people, glamorous, a certain rather tinselly world, I must admit, is what I quite enjoyed.
Did you ever have stage fright, and do you know?
I don't quite know what it means. I mean, I'm always nervous before going on stage. There's no question about that. At every performance, there's a little touch of nerves, obviously much more so on a first night. But once I'm on, I don't think it worries me. If I suddenly think, oh, I'm going to dry up, then I have a moment's panic. But even that, I feel sufficiently confident about that I could walk to the wings and look at the prompt copy and come back again if necessary.
My guest is Alec Guinness. He's written a new memoir. It's titled Blessings in Disguise. You joined the Navy in World War II. And I wonder if it gave you any ideas about acting, because you were exposed to so many different kinds of people and different experiences and different cultures as you sailed around the world.
Well, I think part of the title of my rather odd book, Blessings in Disguise, lies in my naval experience, insofar as if it hadn't been for the war, and God knows, we can do without wars, I would no doubt have stayed in the West End theatre in England. I would have moved with many delightful people, pretty frivolous, pretty light-headed, always concerned about what was next happening in the theatre. Well, the war came as literally a bombshell. I was just starting on what looked like a promising career, so it was a bit wretched to say goodbye to that. But it moved me for the next few years among people whom I was unlikely to meet, not from the point of view of observing them or what they were like, but getting to know men on the lower decks, and then later on I became an officer, and realizing that the world wasn't just theater. On the other hand, I had to perform as such, and I never knew what I was doing quite as a naval officer, and I was in command of a little ship built here in Quincy Yard in Boston. And so I really acted being a naval officer, or my idea of what a naval officer might be like. And I've always maintained that was the best performance I've given. I mean, it wasn't a very impressive one, and it was a very very junior thing, but it was a long run.
Did having the uniform make it even more like playing a part?
Oh, of course, yes. I dressed up as it.
Was there any theater during the war in England? Were the theaters functioning?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was blacked out. The theaters closed for a few weeks when we thought London might be bombed out. But then they opened again. No, they did very well.
After the war, you returned to the stage. Were you afraid you'd be rusty?
Not only rusty, I wondered if I had any talent, if I'd had it, whether it was still there. I was a bit alarmed. And when Laurence Olivier and Ralph Richardson invited me to join them at the Old Vic for a season or two, I was delighted, A, to have the work. But I said, yes, but please, every part you offer me must be different from the other one, because I don't know where I'm going. And so maybe among those four or five or six parts that come my way, I will get an indication. Well, it sounds a very vain thing to say, but I played in those plays, and by the end of those seasons I still didn't know, because each one had offered me some measure of success.
Well, several years after the war you started making movies. Did you say to yourself, I want to do movies now?
No, it wasn't that. I'd never been particularly interested in movies. I don't know why. I'd loved going to them, but I'd never sort of thought of myself as going into movies. I thought I probably hadn't got the right face, or there was always a lot of talk about photogenic qualities and so on. But at the very beginning of the war, I had written a stage adaptation of Great Expectations, which was performed, and I was in it. And that was seen by David Lean and Ronald Neim, who were working together then. And at the end of the war, 1945, beginning of 1946, they were going to make a film of Great Expectations, and they remembered seeing me, and I was still in the Navy when they contacted me, saying, you know, would you like to come and play that part you played on the stage on film? And I'd always rather thought, if ever I do a film, the first one must be something that I've already played in the theatre, so at least I know what I'm at so far as the character's concerned. Then I can put myself in the hands of technicians. And that's what happened.
Did your friends on the stage act as if you betrayed them when you started making movies?
No, I don't think so particularly. There used to be a rather sort of theatrical snobby thing about, oh, so-and-so's become...